Lecture 12, Communist Revolution in Russia.
In the previous two lectures, we discussed fascism and communism as theoretical challenges to liberal democracy. In the next several lectures, we're going to move from theory to practice. Well, looking at communist and fascist rhetoric helps us to understand, to some degree, what made these theories attractive to millions of people. It doesn't really explain why communism or fascism came to power in specific contexts and specific countries, of course. Although communism took root to some degree all over Europe, of course, it was only in Russia, in the European context, that communism came to power. Answering this question of why this happened is important, partly because simply the geopolitical role that the Soviet Union will play in the 20th century makes this an important phenomenon, or the consequences of it are crucial to world politics in the 20th century. But also, exploring the reasons for communist success in Russia is important because we will see a similar kind of face-off between liberal democracy and communism in other third world revolutions in the 20th century, which closely follow the Russian model. In other words, while the Russian Revolution is an anomaly in Europe, it becomes a norm, not the norm, but a norm outside of Europe for the rest of the world. We've already begun to answer the question of why communist revolutions succeeded in Russia. That is, the first part of the answer to that question is in the evolution of Marxist thought from Marx to Lenin, or the evolution of socialism to communism, which made it more adaptable to the situation in Russia. Before Lenin, socialists wouldn't even have thought about Russia as a place where revolution could happen. This doesn't mean, and I think it's important to state this, it doesn't mean that communism caused the Russian Revolution, but it allowed the Bolsheviks to see the Russian Revolution as a potential breeding ground, or as a potential place for them to act, to take advantage of the revolutionary situation when it arose, even though it flew in the face of most of the traditional accepted notions about when and where revolutions would occur. But this theoretical adaptation is only a small part of the story. To get at the specificity of the Russian Revolution, we have to examine the historical reasons why, for many politically active Russians, communism seemed a more attractive alternative to liberalism in 1917. And I emphasize that politically active Russians, because there were millions of Russians that probably had no idea what was going on with the revolution, but those who were politically active. This doesn't mean, of course, that it turned out to be an attractive alternative down the line, but only that in 1917 it seemed like an attractive alternative to many people. So what is the historical context then that makes the Bolshevik Revolution comprehensible? In basic terms, we have to begin with a Russian Empire in the late 19th and early 20th century, which was undergoing a very slow evolution towards a liberal political system and towards a capitalist industrial society, but much more slowly than the other European countries, and so slowly that there were even more disaffected groups, I think, within Russia than there were in the Western European countries. Politically, Russia was still an autocracy, with the Tsar Nicholas II on the throne since 1894. He pursued a policy of imperial expansion. Russia, of course, was an empire, of a systematic Russification of the empire, a clampdown on all political opposition, including the illegality of political parties, and including persecution of Jews and other minorities. However, this begins to change a bit after Russia's defeat in the war with Japan in 1904 or 5. This defeat opens a crisis of confidence, opens a little hole within the autocratic system. In this hole opened by the war with Japan, opposition groups begin to demand more representative institutions. And a broad-based coalition of groups, from workers to students to professionals, forced Nicholas II to grant some concessions. This was the so-called 1905 revolution, the prelude to 1917. Nicholas then issues, in October of 1905, a famous manifesto in which he agrees to the principle of constitutionalism, and he promises to create an elected representative body called the Duma. However, in practice, after 1905, the Duma had no real powers, and the Constitution never questioned the absolute authority of the Tsar. So this is the kind of slow movement I'm talking about, the slow movement towards liberalism. At least the basic framework, the beginning of a constitutional liberal governmental system, but in practice really still largely an absolutist traditional regime. Socially and economically, Russia was still a traditional agrarian rural society, with over four-fifths of its population as peasants living on the land. And just to give you a sense of contrast, in England, that the percentage of peasants at that time was only 12% of the population, and in France, the Western European country with perhaps the greatest percentage, it was still only 35%. So this is a dramatic difference. Peasants in Russia had only been emancipated from serfdom since 1861, and they still had complicated legal relations to the land, which mostly kept them tied to it. So whereas before emancipation, serfs were required to work on the master's land, after emancipation, peasants were usually forced to do the same work in order to pay off their debts to their former masters. So it was not formal servitude, but it was effectively a similar kind of relationship. Moreover, the terms of emancipation made it difficult for peasants to consolidate strips of land, to make improvements on their own land, or to make the transition from subsistence farming to a kind of productive agriculture. So it was difficult, in other words, to modernize the agrarian society given the structure of post-emancipation Russian society. Some of the peasants now owned their own land after emancipation, but there was still a great land hunger. In other words, the majority of this agrarian population were not prosperous peasants, but landless laborers, people who most wanted their own piece of land, who worked on huge estates owned by the traditional aristocracy. Because of this history of great oppression and land hunger, Russian peasants had a history of revolutionary fervor. In other words, this agrarian population, this peasant population, was very, very different from, say, the French peasant population or even the American peasant population, who were small farmers, a country of smallholders, that kind of Jeffersonian ideal, which provided in France and in the United States a stable base for a liberal democratic government. This is a different kind of very poor, illiterate, landless peasantry. Of those of the population who are not peasants, first, there's a group of decadent aristocrats, the ones who own these big expanses of land. Unlike in Britain, the Russian aristocracy never enters business, never becomes an entrepreneurial aristocracy. Improving productivity on the land, that's one of the elements of the British agricultural revolution, that the aristocrats themselves become a new entrepreneurial class. This doesn't happen in Russia. Second, there's a very small middle class, obviously because industrialization is recent and limited, and also because much of the industrialization is state-sponsored, which means there's a small middle class. There's not really the entrepreneurial private class that there was in England, say, in Western Europe. The third non-peasant group is a group of intelligentsia, intellectuals, not connected to any of these socioeconomic groups, but intellectuals who are generally disaffected with the regime. The intelligentsia was a traditional source of revolutionary disturbances in Russia, from political assassinations to conspiring to endless debates on the future of Russia. So the intelligentsia did provide a tradition of revolutionary action that Lenin and the Bolsheviks could draw on. The last social group in pre-war society was the working class. From the 1890s, a rapid industrialization policy that was pursued by the state, or encouraged by the state at least, resulted in small pockets of highly industrialized regions, usually cities like St. Petersburg, Moscow, Kiev, and a few mining centers in the Ukraine. Likewise, this created a small, highly concentrated working class in these three or four cities and mining regions. Because of late and rapid industrialization, they built mostly large factories with modern equipment. So again, you have large groups of workers together, isolated together, or I should say grouped together. But conditions were really no better than in 1830s England, that is, in the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. No protective legislation, simply raw capitalist development. It's also important, I think, that Russian industry was very inflexible. Late industrializers trying to catch up have less leeway in their profit margins to give wage increases to workers, making it difficult to negotiate basic economic improvements. This actually becomes a condition or a characteristic in general of late industrializers in the 20th century. As a result of these conditions, the Russian working class in the decades before the war was exceptionally militant. Again, remember, if we go back to kind of the reverse of what Marx expected, we're talking about a moment of transition to capitalism when the conditions are poor, the workers tend to be more exploited, and this is the moment when they're going to be more revolutionary, not, in fact, in the more mature capitalist societies. In situations like pre-war Russia, where it was difficult to gain basic economic improvements through strikes, so the workers were striking to gain basic improvements, but again, the employers, because they were trying to compete with countries like England, which had established industrial societies, it was very difficult to compete with them and give your workers more benefits and improve conditions. So the employers tended to be very inflexible, which means that strikes quickly became political. They quickly became revolutionary. They couldn't gain basic economic improvements, so they quickly turned revolutionary. So this made, in other words, the Russian working class in 1914 or in 1917 one of the most revolutionary in Europe, or one of the most radical in Europe. In the summer of 1914, the strike movement was so serious that some observers actually thought that a revolution would break out that summer once the Tsar had declared war. What's important about all of this in building a basis for a communist revolution? Who was unhappy, and why did this favor communism? To begin with, almost everyone was unhappy, except for the decadent aristocracy, who were really too weak to defend themselves. The middle class is small, desirous of liberal reforms. The intelligentsia is disgruntled and conspiring for revolution. The very poor peasants want land, and the industrial proletariat, who's concentrated in a few cities, are facing these inflexible employers. So everybody is really disgruntled, but there's no one to bring them together. You know, there's no one kind of group, organization, political movement that can bring them together. 19th century Marxists were still waiting around for the capitalist revolution, right? They thought that there was nothing to be done until the bourgeoisie made their own revolution. So they were kind of waiting. Into this situation, then, we have the First World War, whose brutality and tremendous sacrifice undermined what support was left for the Tsarist regime. Like the other European governments, Russia enters the war enthusiastically. The strength of the Russian Empire had always been its huge army and its military prowess in subduing imperial domains. And they often used, the Tsarist regime had often used exploits abroad as a way of creating support at home. The problem is that this tactic can backfire when alienation at home is too great. And of course, that's what happens, because a total war like this requires immense amounts of sacrifice You know, it's not just a few thousand cavalry going off and fighting a war and coming home. It's millions of people expected to participate in this. People have to cheer at the victories but hang tough at the defeats in this kind of total war. Instead, people become increasingly critical of the defeats, especially given the mismanagement of the war by the Tsar. And he makes, in some sense, a tactical mistake by insisting on commanding the troops himself. And by doing that, the defeats in the war become personally connected to the Tsar. Of course, he lost crucial battles in 1914. Then the German invasion in 1915 results in 2 million casualties that year alone. By 1917, 5 million Russian soldiers have died. This slaughter on the battlefield, combined with the suspension of constitutional rights, the Duma is suspended, Constitution is suspended in 1915 and 16, and there are other things like a reactionary court. Everyone probably knows the story of Rasputin, the kind of evil advisor to the Tsar. The peasant unhappiness, of course, at being sent off to die, all of this combined to create an overwhelming opposition to the existing regime. In basic terms, the disjuncture between an anachronistic regime and the 20th century demands of total warfare, trench warfare, massive mobilization, this gap was simply too great to paper over. Everywhere in Europe, we talked about how there was opposition, growing opposition to the war, but in a country which had so little support networks to begin with, where people were alienated to begin with, obviously it made it even more difficult to sustain. Especially think of a country like Russia, where the decision to go to war isn't even made by the representatives of the people. It's made by the Tsar. So when the war starts to go badly, there's not even that sense that we ourselves have somehow participated in this decision. So it makes perfect sense that Russia, as the weakest of the 19th century regimes, is the first to dissolve. The revolution of 1917 comes in two stages, in February and October. And it was the second revolution, of course, that brings the Bolsheviks to power. The first revolution of February 1917 begins by women staging food riots, which turn quickly into political demonstrations. These demonstrations turned from ordinary riots to revolution when soldiers refused to fire on them. And that will become an important transition moment in all revolutions, when the army fraternizes and refuses to fire on the demonstrators. As had happened in 1905, protests had both a popular dimension, that is, these protesters in the streets, and an elite dimension, that is, professionals demanding political concessions, demanding liberal reforms. The Tsar happened to be absent from Moscow at the time, and what seems clear is that he had little sense of what was going on. He refused to give in. He refused to give any real powers to the Duma. He gave orders simply that the disorder in the streets should be dissolved. You know, that was sort of his only order. But the police themselves were dissolving into the demonstrators, and troops who were brought into control were fraternizing as well. After a week, the revolutionary crowd seemed to have taken over the capital, and the military authorities had no reliable troops to restore order. So after this first week of chaos, it was actually the military authorities, rather than the Tsar, who finally decided to open negotiations with members of an illegally formed Duma. In other words, the legal Duma had been dissolved in 1915, so some of those members had gotten back together and formed an illegal association. In these negotiations, they reestablished the Duma, which sets up a provisional government, after which the Tsar quickly abdicated on March 17th. The new Duma was dominated by the liberal middle-class professionals, businessmen, intellectuals, and they set out to implement a basic liberal revolution: civil rights, universal suffrage, freedom, civil rights and civil freedoms for the Jews. They called a constituent assembly for a new constitution. Again, a classic liberal political revolution. But as we know, this liberal political regime only lasted a few months before the Bolshevik Revolution. So what happened? Why couldn't it consolidate? From the outset, the liberal government was disadvantaged by the social and economic conditions of the country. The Duma members, those middle-class professionals, were the same kinds of people that filled parliaments throughout Europe. The problem was that in Russia, they only represented a small minority of the population and of the population's interest. The majority peasant population wasn't nearly as interested in civil and political rights. They weren't that interested in the vote. What they wanted was land reform. But the redistribution of land not only went beyond liberalism, it even threatened, or potentially threatened, the principle of private property. So the liberal regime was not talking about this kind of massive land reform. Adding to the existing social and economic problems was the continuation of the war, where Russian soldiers were still dying in record numbers. With all of these problems, there was a clear space for an alternative, and it was the Bolsheviks that were best able to formulate and sell this alternative. Along with other socialists, the Bolsheviks had participated in the February Revolution, but Bolshevik power, like the other socialists, was concentrated not in the Duma, but in the Soviets. And the Soviets were local soldiers and workers' councils, which had sprung up spontaneously in the February Revolution at the same time that the Duma was reestablished. So what existed after February 1917 is what becomes known as dual power. You have a kind of popular revolutionary power in the Soviets, and you have a formal constitutional power in the Duma. The Central Soviet was in St. Petersburg, but the Congress of Soviets in June of 1917 attracted 138 locals, plus soldiers' councils from army units. Various kinds of socialists participated in the Soviets, but the two main groups vying for power were the Bolsheviks on the one hand and the Mensheviks on the other. And the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks come out of a 1903 split in the Russian socialist movement. And what caused that split and what continued it is that the Mensheviks were traditional Marxists in the sense that they thought the role of the Soviets was to basically support the liberal revolution, to be watchdogs for the workers, but not to push it to a socialist revolution. Because once again, Russia was not ready for that. Russia was not industrially developed enough to have that revolution. The Bolsheviks, on the other hand, were the only group who thought Russia could simply skip the bourgeois revolution and go directly to the socialist. So for the Bolsheviks, the Soviets should wrest political power away from the Duma and assume control of the revolution. So Mensheviks and Bolsheviks saw a very different role for the Soviets. Lenin had outlined his program for what the Bolsheviks should do and what the Soviets should do in his so-called April Theses, in which he called for no cooperation with the liberal government, exactly the opposite, in other words, of what the Mensheviks were talking about. Instead, working through the Soviets, the Bolsheviks tried to rally the country around the slogan of peace, land, and bread, plus all power to the Soviets. In other words, an immediate end to the war, that was peace, land to the peasants, and food to the cities, that was the bread. With this message, the Bolshevik Party grew from 25,000 in February of 1917 to 350,000 by October of 1917. So it grew to a significant mass party by the time of the Second Revolution, with a platform that spoke directly to the needs of the proletariat in the cities, the soldiers who were mostly peasants, and the peasants themselves on the land. The opportunity for the Second Revolution in October comes with the growing polarization of forces, and thus the eroding support for the provisional government. Of course, dual power is increasingly unstable as the Bolsheviks are pushing non-cooperation. So that's one piece of the puzzle. The Bolsheviks are actively destabilizing the government. But on the other hand, authority across the country seems to be falling apart on its own, even without the Bolshevik presence. That is, if the government is not going to declare peace, then soldiers simply decided to stop fighting. So thousands of soldiers are simply deserting the front and coming home. Likewise, if the government wouldn't give peasants the land, they would seize it. So again, around the country, thousands of peasants are simply seizing their own land and taking it. So the Liberal government is losing its authority, losing its sense of legitimacy. In contrast, of course, the Bolsheviks seem to have their pulse on what people really wanted now: peace, land, and bread. On the other extreme, conservatives loyal to the monarchy staged a right-wing coup in July of 1917. So in other words, what you have is a kind of evaporation of the middle ground. You have a conservative coup on the one hand of forces loyal to the monarchy, and you have the Bolsheviks organizing the anti-liberal group over here, and there's very little support left for the middle. By October 1917, then, when the Bolsheviks staged their revolution, they're rising more against a political vacuum than against a functioning government. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that the revolution was spontaneous. It was carefully planned. Unlike February, which was spontaneous, the October Revolution was carefully planned and executed under the leadership of Lenin and Trotsky and others. Because of this, some Western historians accuse the Bolsheviks of an illegitimate coup. That is, in other words, the only reason they were able to take power is because they had a tightly organized party, and that gave them the focus and the discipline to take over. It's true. That part of it, I think, is true. And it's also true that the simple fact that the Bolsheviks had a clear plan for taking power gave them an advantage over all other groups who didn't. But this conspiracy theory is much too simple an explanation for the October Revolution, one that ignores the deep tensions and cleavages in Russian society that the Bolsheviks didn't create, but they only took advantage of. So liberals in Russia had really only a very shallow political and social base. There were too few people in Russia, too few politically active people in Russia who were satisfied with constitutional rights and the vote. As historians have pointed out, Bolsheviks couldn't have seized power without widespread popularity, both among workers where their support was almost complete, among the soldiers who wanted the war to end, and among the peasants who wanted land, not parliament. So they were speaking directly to all of these groups. Now, of course, by the terms of liberal democratic theory, the Bolshevik coup was illegitimate, since it clearly rejected the basic principle of majority rule. The Bolsheviks justified their coup, and they justified their dictatorship, based on their representation not of the majority of the population, but of the working class. And if you follow this logic, because in Russia the working class was only a minority of the population, they claimed to speak for a minority which would in the future be a majority. As Russia industrialized further and built a modern society, its peasants would become workers. So the Bolsheviks were representing the workers of the future as much as the workers of today. But of course, that still gave them a different kind of justification for seizing power. And thus, they replaced the liberal democratic principle of one man, one vote, that basic majority principle, and created a system that was legitimized by a new unit, the class. Their claim to represent the class, even though it was not a majority of the population, created a different kind of political justification. So government then is supposed to act in defense of the rights of a class, the working class, not, once again, as with the fascists, in defense of the individual. While this dramatic change altered the course of 20th century Russian history, it also had an enormous impact outside Russia. For workers and peasants around the world, it became the model to emulate. Within Europe, it inspired the post-war generation of working-class activists who joined the new communist parties and looked to the Soviet Union as the workers' homeland. And that period of 1918 to 1923 in Western Europe is one in which many people thought that there were going to be communist revolutions across Europe. There were widespread strike movements, millions of workers in the street, aborted revolutions, local Soviet movements modeled on the Russian Revolution, and so on. It's not really until after 1923 that those movements are suppressed, calmed down, and so on, and the immediacy of a potential communist revolution throughout Europe dies down after that, or the fear of that. Outside Europe, revolutionaries like Mao Zedong pushed Lenin's adaptation of Marxism even further, turning it into the primary vehicle for peasant revolution in the 20th century, when, of course, Marxism didn't start out as that kind of theory. In contrast, the property classes throughout Europe were so traumatized by the fear of Bolshevism that preventing it becomes one of the central priorities of Western politics, whether fascism or liberalism, in the early 20th century. So whether as utopia or as nightmare, the Russian Revolution becomes a central image and metaphor in the interwar crisis of the West.